respectable.
Again, assuming he's going to tell us about his 30 days here in Alaska and throw in considerable cover, which I think we're all interested in, I think we'll have him introduce himself in the usual way so we'll know who we're getting down on tape. We would like to have his full name, his address, his wife's name, how old he is, which is a question we even ask the women, and of course let us know when he came to Alaska, and then he can just start telling us his story. So, Mike, if you want to sit down, you'll put this in your soul if you want to stand up.
Oh, I'll stand a little while till I kind of get a little shaky, then I'll sit down.
This is Mike Young, and he's going to give you his age, address, his wife's name, and when he came to Alaska.
Mr. Kime, ladies and gentlemen. Well, I came to Alaska with my family to Juneau in 1896. And my wife's name is Dolly. And let's see, what else?
How old, Frank?
Oh, I thought you'd skip that. No, on my next birthday, I'll be 70. Well, about a week or 10 days ago, I came down with this flu that's going around the town here. And as an aftermath of that, I wound up with a kind of a barnacle condition. So I went and seen the doctor, and he wrote me out a prescription, and he told me, Frank, if you want to get over this, he said, you got to keep your mouth shut. Well, you see, I couldn't have a better excuse for just saying a few words, because I don't want to get on the outs with the doctor. Well, this cold weather, well, I should tell you a few early day sourdough yarns, but I don't know about it. As I said, I don't want to get on the outs with the doctors, he told me. Not to talk too much.
Start off by telling us something that came here and home.
The Fairbanks?
Yes, Alaska
General. Oh, Alaska generally. Yeah, well, I guess maybe I'd better sit down. I could do better. Well, I came to from Juneau to Skagway, and that was in 98. As a little youngster with my mother and father. Then we came into Dawson, I think in 99. We come to Fairbanks here in 1905. And most of my family has been here ever since. Now, us pioneers in the Historical Society, we have requests for certain kinds of stories, and we've had a request for to tell a story of the first electrical power that was put together here in the Tanana Valley. Well, I don't know too much about that, but I have an old-time friend that I knew from, you might say, the start of the century. I put a little more color to it in the Soapy Smith days that can give you the full details on that. Now, due to a little throat condition that I have, well, I'd like to call on Mr. Sheldon to kind of pinch hit for me and give us that story of first the power plant in Fairbanks, and at a later date I'd be glad to give you some real good old stories and tell you some more of my life in Alaska.
Well, we certainly understand that you do have this bronchial condition, Frank. Would you object to our letting you as the speaker for our January meeting?
Not at all. I hope to be able to get over this.
You take good care of that throat, and I'll send you some cocktail.
Well, Mr. Toastmaster and ladies and gentlemen of the society, this is rather fantastic to be jerked right out of the audience like this to substitute for such a famous character as my good old pioneer friend Frank P. Young, Sr. he talks about his voice. I've been talking all day too. But since the question that he brings up here as to the early day electrical services for the interior of Fairbanks, it's true that I am in a position to give you, I think, as much of the pioneering history of electricity in Fairbanks as anyone, because I was part of it, especially back a good many years ago. I believe the Bible says in the beginning there was no light, or was light, I guess it was. But in Fairbanks, in the beginning, there was no light, electrically speaking. They used candles and kerosene lamps and lanterns. And even the women curled their hair with a curling iron that went in the kerosene lamp. When the Northern Commercial Company, known as the NC Company to us, took over the Barnett Trading Post here and made it into their principal interior agency or trading post, they salvaged a couple of brickyard boilers out of some old boat that was no longer serviceable, and they also salvaged a couple of these little direct connected direct current little generators for generating electricity for the use of the boat, and put it in their station here to steam heat and electric light their own store, which is now in the same, which was in the same location that the present NC Company plant is. The neighbors around there, or the other business people around that started to develop around the NC Company, started clamoring for to be hooked on to the steam pipe and to hook onto the electric wires so they could have some steam heat and electricity. And of course it wasn't long before the little improvised heating and lighting plant was badly overloaded. And so they had to salvage some more boilers out of some more boats that were no longer usable as boats. And little by little, they kept adding to their electric plant here. As a matter of fact, the plant grew like Topsy. Little by little, they kept adding more in order to accommodate the people around them. The NC Company, as we knew it in those days, was not an electric company. As a matter of fact, they were a wholesale liquor outfit to start with all due respect to the fine people that have been associated with the NC down through the years, including myself. The NC Company started to branch out and become more and more a trading institution, an established trading post then all over the country. However, they kept adding to their little electric plant here, which was a direct current plant, as against the alternating current service we now have. And I went into the plant in 1908 and took over the operation of the plant. I came here from the Skagway, Alaska plant, where Frank, as he said, was a little kid when I was chief engineer of the power plant there. Of course, I had a hard life, is what makes me look so tough. But anyway, the... I went into the power plant at Skagway in 1903 on the night shift, and after 2 years I became engineer in charge of the power plant at Skagway, which was an alternating current plant owned by the Northwest Light and Power Company of Seattle. And in 1908 I left there and came into Fairbanks to dig gold. I wanted to find out where all this gold was coming from that they were shipping out of the country over the White Pass Railroad and down through Skagway. And I said, well, with all that gold coming out here, they certainly must be more in there. So I came on in. Fairbanks, and I found out pretty early in the game that digging gold from 200 or 300 feet under the ground was not for me. So I went to the NC company and made application for a position as engineer in the power plant. I had been prospecting out here with an old fellow for 2 or 3 months, and I came in with a full, beautiful brown beard and one of these turtleneck sweaters with sourdough all over the front of it, because I'd been doing the cooking. And Mr. Richmond, the head of the NC company, when I asked him for a position as engineer in his power plant, he said, "Are you an engineer?" Well, I said, "No, I'm a cook, but I'm very anxious to change occupation." So he kind of grinned and he asked me what made me think I would be entitled to a position in his power plant. Well, I said, "I have just left the power plant at Skagway, Alaska, where I was in charge of the plant for 5 years, and I have documentary evidence to give you to support that statement." And he said, "Well, okay, I'll put you on the list here." And he said, "I'll keep you in mind." So he put me in the power plant in 1908, and I was there till 1913. The first year and a half, I was the engineer there under Mr. Matthews, who was the superintendent, and later on I was engineer in charge of the power plant under Mr. Bob Menzies, the bookkeeper. I don't know how many people who were here today, present here tonight, I mean, who were in Fairbanks in 1908. Possibly Mrs. Shermer. Forbes was here in 1908. And yes, Mrs. Rust was here, and Mrs. Shermer was here, and I don't know how many more of you who might have been here at that time, but I was there in 1913. And the NC plant kept growing and growing to accommodate the people of this town as the town grew and expanded. And they kept adding more second-hand direct current machinery. Mm-hmm. Mr. Richmond picked up 2 or 3 second-hand rigs out in Seattle and shipped them in here, and we kept expanding the plant, but it was direct current. Now, I don't know how many of you people might realize the difference between direct current and alternating current, but a direct current plant located up near the federal building where the plant was, to send electricity down to a location like this, you had to have wires, copper wires about as big as your thumb, and they ran those wires all over the town, and you had to carry about 120 volts up there or more in order to be able to see the electric light down here when you turned it on. You'd almost have to light a candle to be sure it was going. And that's the difference between the alternating current plant and the direct current plant. So they operated that plant for until they sold out to the city. And in those days, everybody paid $1 a month meter rent. And everybody had these little meters that the company bought in, shipped in here from the General Electric Company, that cost about $7.50 a piece. And they got $1 a month meter rent out of them. That was $12 a year meter rent, to say nothing of the amount of current you paid for that was wound up by that meter. And the income from the meter rent here practically paid the operation of the plant. I suppose some of the early day managers of the NC company might probably turn over in their grave if they thought anybody was exposing some of these things that went on in those days. But I felt it was all wrong, but I wasn't the manager of the plant, I was just operating it. Finally, the agitation went on here in Fairbanks to buy out this private corporation that was robbing the people. And we'll build our own plant, and then we'll practically get our electricity for nothing, because we'll be won't have to pay any big profit to the private corporation that's manufacturing electricity for us. Well, all of you darling people that are paying electric light bills today will realize what an awful mistake that was. Because look at your electric light bill today and look at the electric light bill of those days, and you'll see who's getting robbed by who. The highest electrical rate in the world, as I had understood it at that time in 1900, was at Whitehorse, Yukon Territory. 50 cents a kilowatt. Finally, the what they call the Chamber of Commerce up there was known as the whitest Board of Trade. They got very busy, and they prevailed on the electric light company up there to reduce their rates, and they finally got it down to 40 cents. Dawson also had a 40 cent rate and finally got it down to 30, and Fairbanks in the beginning had a 30 cents a kilowatt, 35 cents a kilowatt first, then they got it down to 30, finally to 25 cents a kilowatt, and boy, we thought we were in heaven. And it was at that time that my wife, who had curled her hair with the homemade, what do you call it, curling iron in the lamp chimney for years, somebody gave her a electric curling iron for Christmas. And I came home from the shop one evening, and as soon as I came in the house and she was cooking dinner, and I smelled a peculiar odor, and I recognized it as overheated electric wires, because having worked in a plant for years, I recognized that peculiar smell of overheated electric wires. And I came in and I sniffed around, and I noticed the nearer I got to the bedroom, the stronger this odor was, and I finally went in. Here was this electric iron resting on its little metal business there, red hot, and sapping the electricity out of the plug-in there, and boy, I jerked that out of the wall in a hurry. And I came out of there with that thing red hot, and I said, "Listen, darling, I'm up here working my fingers to the knuckles trying to make a living, and you're here pouring my money down into the NC coppers here at 25 cents a kilowatt." And I said, "Just please don't let that happen again." So she just looked at me with a kind of a sickly grin and didn't say anything. She was smart enough not to say anything. It wasn't more than a week, I came home again, and the same odor I smelled. Jesus, I rushed in again, and she did the same thing. She was busy cooking supper and forgot about the thing. So I went in and jerked it out again, and I said, "Listen, this thing is going out in the river," and we lived near the river at that time, and I went out and I heaved it around like this, way out, and it took a big plunk in the river. And I said, "Let that be a lesson to you. Go on back to the original idea here." 2 weeks later, the end of the first of the month came, and I got a bill from Smith's Gun Store for $8 for a new electric hair curler, twice as big as the other one. Well, I said, "That shows you, mister, that you can't win. When you're arguing with Mama, you just can't win." So that was electricity in those days. And when the people of Fairbanks thought by selling out, buying out the NC Company old plant and building a fine big new plant for themselves, they were going to get a fine break on getting cheap electricity. What kind of a break you're getting. And that is the story of electricity in Fairbanks from the days of the candles when they started down to the present day with a fine big alternating current latest model generating plant over here that is costing a lot of money to operate, and they now want $1.5 million bond issue to put in a new generator. And in my day, you could put in 10 generators for $1.5 million. That's to what extent things have changed since those days. And thank you very much for this opportunity. Yes.
Do you remember about the Gordon power plant on 30?
Very, very much.
When did that come in?
Well, it came in when he had the roller rink over there, and he got mad at the MC company for charging him so much for electricity, so he decided to put in a plant of his own. And old Alec Kerr was his chief engineer over there, a former steamboat engineer, and they installed a direct current plant over there in adjoining the roller rink, over where Haglund's...
Well, it's right under our house. I mean,
yeah, that's right. It's over near where your house was, and near where the Fairbanks Clinic was, is now. Well, I would say it was 1910 or 11 along in there, because I was with the NC Power Plant from 1908 to 1913 when I resigned and went into the automobile business. I sent out and got a new little Ford Model T automobile in 1913 so I could take my girl out riding. And the first 2 weeks I had it here, in July 1913, was the year they shipped the first little airplane in here. And all the people from out in the creeks phoned in for me to come out and get them to come in and see the excitement. And I went out and back and forth, and in 2 weeks, while I was on my vacation from the power plant, I took in over $1,250 with it. I got the impression that there was money in the automobile business. But before I got through with the automobile business, I felt like the kid whose father had told him there was money in chickens. And after cutting open eight, he couldn't find a cent. And when his father got through beating him up, he came to the conclusion there was no money in chickens. And I found out the hard way there wasn't as much money in the automobile business as it appeared from the beginning.
So, what did you get for dinner the night through the curling iron in the river?
I got some burnt caribou chops, I think it was, as I remember. But they were burnt too, just about as bad as the curling iron was. And I got burnt up in various ways.
Bobby, you might as well tell them who you unloaded the white elephant to in the garden in the automobile business.
That is another sad story. I had the first garage here, and in 2 years I had over $2,000 on my books. And all I was doing was overhauling Ford cars, putting gasoline in their tanks and new tires on their cars, and then try to get your money. And who was it that wasn't paying? The doctors and the lawyers and the professional people that I thought always paid their bill. One doctor here owed me over $600. Before he died. So I found a victim and I told him what a wonderful business the automobile business was, and I hated to get out of it, but I was ambitious to establish a transportation system between here and the coast, and I'd like to make him a present of this deal, practically. So who did I hook on the deal but Paul Grimond? And I unloaded the garage to Paul Grimond. Judge Pratt, who was Harry Pratt, the lawyer, drew up the papers. I don't remember whether I ever did get all the money for it, but as far as I'm concerned, it's written off, and I think I got paid. I was very happy to get rid of the garage business. And I was amused just recently when I understood that Mr. Grimond, after a few years, got out of the garage still. And I wondered how much he had on his book.
Could you tell us...
Pardon?
Go ahead, Frank.
Why,
I'd like to
open the floor to a few questions. If you start by getting an answer, what was the fuel source to generate the tremendous energy?
You will notice that there's not many trees left around the hills of Fairbanks. And the fuel was wood. And the men who went out and chopped the wood hauled it in on the first snow, and I would go out with my coonskin coat on out of that hot engine room and scale this wood as they came by with their teams, and I would measure 10,000 cords of wood every year to put into the wood pile up there where they stored their wood. Then we had a little track where we, and a horse that pulled it back into the power plant. I had to check it back into myself, and in that way I could make my books balance. I never had an argument with any of these woodcutters, although I caught one of them one night driving up to the wood yard with a load of wood after I had measured it. And it so happened that I was keeping company with a young lady that lived up in that neighborhood at that time, and I got off duty and I dressed and shaved and cleaned up, and I went up to call on the young lady. And as I went by the wood yard, this foreigner had unloaded all the wood except about a half a cord. And he had that covered over with horse blankets and was starting to pull off for his own house with it as I came along. And I said, "Where are you going with that wood?" Brother, he stopped and was his face red. And he started to cry pretty hard. And I said, "Listen, you drive back here and put that wood back where it belonged, boy. That's one thing that don't go here. You need wood, you get it from someplace else. We're paying you for this wood to put it here." And so that cured, that got around pretty fast, that you better not try to get away with any wood from the NC company, because somebody might be looking down your neck there or hidden behind the big wood piles or something.
That wood yard was down on south to end of town on Barnett Street.
That's right.
I remember them pulling the horse.
Up somewhere near where the
health center is.
Up where the health center is now. That's where the wood yard was.
Well, Fort worked in that power plant for three winters, and it was 4 foot long.
4 foot wood, that's right. Whenever we had a big fire, we had six boilers, and in winter they were pretty badly overloaded, carrying the normal load. Then when a fire would break out, I'd immediately holler for a few crates of bacon to be brought over from the warehouse. And along with the wood, we'd throw in slabs of bacon with the wood in order to keep up the steam.